there is no science at all? What if we did not study the things we are studying? What if we could not study things fast enough? Yet again, what if we had all of the resources in the world to do our research? What if? Just maybe, what if? You are listening to another episode of the podcast, What If? I am Signe Vask, I'm your host. I am a researcher and a lecturer at the University of Tartu. I am also a freelance journalist. Today, we have with us a PhD student from the University of Tartu. Her name is Sanni Färkkilä, and she's going to talk to you about fungi.
It's not like this will cause an apocalypse, but it kind of might.
So you are a PhD student here at the University of Tartu, and you are finishing your first year.
Correct.
Very good. Before we continue, please explain what you are studying here.
Well, I am working in the field of biology, more closely in the program of botany and mycology. And my work revolves around a kind of partnership in nature between fungi and plants that is called mycorrhiza. And what more can I say? There's a lot. I could speak for hours, I guess. But basically, this symbiosis is useful for both the plants and the fungi. They get resources and energy from each other. And there's a whole lot of other benefits that come with it that we're just starting to discover right now. What I'm more specifically interested in is so-called common mycorrhizal networks. These are kind of networks that these fungi form between the plants. So they are inhabiting multiple plants simultaneously. And this forms a so-called wood-wide web that can enable
What was that?
It's the wood wide web.
Wow.
It's not great. So much an official term, but it's very descriptive because it really can be a system that connects every single plant in a forest to each other. So it's quite kind of a sci-fi thought, almost like an Avatarian idea. But actually, it's not so far-fetched. But of course, this is quite hard to study then because it's underground and it's quite fragile and so on. So that's why we still need to do a lot of work in this topic.
And what is that you do more specifically? How do you approach wood wide web?
Wood wide web,
how
yes.
How do you approach it? What do you do there?
Well, my interest is to see more closely what kind of elements and nutrients are moving inside this network. And to do this, I'm actually using something called fluorescent nanoparticles. And these are kind of like very, very tiny flashlights. We can activate them and we can kind of give them to the molecules. And then we will be able to just look at the light and see where they're going inside the network. That's the hope, at least.
Okay, so you have not tried it out this way yet, or
This is not something that I've tried yet, but there are some preliminary studies where they have used these particles in similar ways. So theoretically, it should be possible.
Where do you get your news of science and scientists from?
Well, I would say firstly that the biggest source is, of course, looking at what the people in my field are publishing. I'm in ResearchGate, for example, where I get announcements from if someone publishes a paper, if someone recommends a paper, and so on. And more informally, I'm on Insta following a lot of people, both amateur and like academic people working in these topics and just trying to interact and see what's happening, learn new species and so on. And also in Facebook as well, I'm in quite many kind of mycology and botany themed groups interacting. On Twitter, I'm not at the moment.
So I think in some sense, I don't know if you agree with me, social media helps a lot when talking about these things.
I think so. I think so. And it's becoming more and more important, not just in general, but also for scientists, I think. It's becoming more important to not to be able to network only through conferences and such, like face-to-face interactions, but also in the media.
Do you publish your research or your findings or your ideas somewhere on social media?
Well, right now I'm quite active on this Quora site. I'm like making answers to questions and also like posting some things. So that's like a thing that I'm into right now, and I find it quite rewarding when I see that people are like resharing the answer and it's like moving forward and people are sending me requests that can you please answer this question because they see that I know about this field. So this is just a thing that I'm doing now, I guess, mostly.
What are the news in your field right now? I don't know about maybe some new findings that somehow influence you and your research. Are there any?
Well, the biggest influence in mycology right now is definitely in relation to the massive development in gene sequencing. We are sequencing very fast, a lot of amount of data, and this is really scrambling all the taxonomy. So this means that how we thought that different organisms are related, we find out that, okay, actually, this species is not related to the other species that looks like it at all, or that, okay, this species that we thought was one species is actually three different species, and it's quite a difficult thing to manage sometimes. And what else? Well, all I can say is that the interest in like below ground processes is increasing like constantly. And the more we find out, the more we realize how important these things are, because they've been neglected for quite some time because, yeah, they're underground and we don't really see them. We don't really know how to deal with them. So right now, we're beginning to realize how much of an influence these organisms have on the whole ecosystem and the planet.
But who influences you? Who is your supervisor?
Well, my supervisors, there are three.
Three of them, okay.
They are all in quite different fields. I have Professor Leho Tederso, who is into this mycorrhizal things and doing a lot of stuff, especially with the gene sequencing. Then I have Professor Raivo Jaaniso, who is an optical physicist, who is here to help with this nanoparticle side. And then we have Professor Uno Maorg, who is then a chemist, who is there to deal with the compounds that we're using. So it's quite an interdisciplinary thing.
Which is always a good thing, I would say. But there are three of them. So how does the cooperation, how does it work?
Well, the main responsibility is right now with Professor Tederso. He's like the main supervisor in the project. But mainly when we need some expertise on the particular fields of the other supervisors, then we will go to them. Like the optical measurements, of course, will be done in the physics side. And when we are trying to connect our flashlights to the nutrients, we need the help of Professor Maorg.
Now it's time to go on with the what ifs.
Nice.
Are we ready?
I'm as ready as I can be, I guess.
The first what if you did not study the topic you are studying at the moment?
Well, depends on the view, I guess, if it's personally or academically, but I'm not going to sit here and say that this is like the most important thing ever to do, but still, roots and fungi, they're easy to ignore, but everything in our world is made of smaller things. Like if you think about the cell phone, for example, you have all those circuits and little microchips and also the invisible electrical current that make it work. So even though the phone is the nice fancy thing, it cannot exist without the smaller parts. And also you and me as humans, we cannot exist without the cells and molecules that make us. And actually, fungi, they're like the icebergs of the soil, because you see them, these tiny little mushrooms, and you think nothing of it. You're like, maybe, oh, that's a mushroom, that's cute. But actually, under your feet, there are several tons of fungal hyphae in there. And in fact, the biggest organism in the world is a fungus. It's a type of fungus that is the size of 1,400 football fields. And if you compare it to
that's
the blue
huge.
Whale,
that's
for
huge.
Example, yeah. The blue whale is the length of 1/3 of a single football field. So you might think that it's not important, but actually it quite is. And if we think about organisms in general, I can sit here and say, oh, they're important, we need to protect them, ecosystems are nice, and so on. But it's not just like a hippie thing or something, because actually, like 90 to 80% of vascular plants, meaning plants that have a vascular system, so basically everything else but mosses, they are living with these fungi, and this includes important crop species. It includes like the timber that we use. So they're really like quite essential. And the ecosystems in general as well. We might think that, oh, we're disconnected from the nature. We have all the technology. We don't need nature. We don't need ecosystems. But actually, the ecosystem provides so many services for us that we need. It regulates the nutrients. The pollination makes our fruits and plants grow. The plants produce oxygen. They give us food. They give us raw materials. They give us medication. Not to forget the cultural value and aesthetical value that we get from it. So we might think that we survive without nature, but the fact is that we don't.
I love it how you bring out the chain, that fungi is just one part or one link in the chain, and how it can influence the other links in the chain. So if we are not studying one of those links at all, then we are just neglecting the links in how the nature works and how we use nature and so forth.
Indeed. And if we don't study it, we don't know what is important and what affects what. So it might be that just this one simple thing, if this goes away, the whole system collapses because everything is connected in the end.
Yeah, and you don't know what might happen and what might not happen.
Exactly, exactly. So it's better not to risk it.
What if the worst scenario happened?
Well, I guess I kind of already a bit
touched
upon this, but I would say that the potential that the fungi in the soils would disappear, for example, this would collapse the whole ecosystem and the whole planet, because these fungi, like I said, they're present in nearly all vascular plants, and the plants cannot grow properly without these fungi. So if they are not there, then the plant communities will collapse. And if the plant communities will collapse, then again, the other organisms that are dependent on the plants will collapse. And then in the end, if the ecosystems collapse, so will all the services, the oxygen production and so on that I touched upon. So it's not just minimizing the negatives. It's also that because these fungi are so helpful to the plants. If we want to, for example, increase the yields of our crops or make our trees grow faster and stronger, we might have some help with the fungi. If we can know, for example, oh, these fungi are really good at bringing this and this nutrient to this and this plant, we can actually introduce these fungi to the crop plant, for example, and therefore it's kind of like a natural fertilizer, and it increases the yield of the crops. So it's not only about avoiding the negative consequences, it can also be a positive boost. And actually, there are already in the market some kind of mycorrhizal inoculants, which are basically just the fungal spores that people can give to their plants, and it might improve their growth. But again, because we don't know so much which plants benefit from which fungi, currently it's just a mix of fungi, and you give it to any plant, and it might help some, but it might not also. So we should study this to find out the good bears so that we can actually get the benefits.
So what you are basically saying is that we need more information.
For sure, for sure. Fungi are such a diverse group, and just recently only we've started to be able to really study them because of the development of the genetic approaches. Because before that, it was quite hard to actually study this underground part. And there are still challenges, of course, but it's getting better, and we should keep working on it, for sure.
What if you had all the resources you needed for carrying out your research?
Well, I played around with this thought a bit in my head, and a first thing that comes to my mind would be more helping hands and more expertise, because these are the most important things. But of course, with the especially large-scale experiments, money is always a limiting thing as well. So if I had all of those, I would transport my current tiny growth chamber experiment into natural forests, and I would put cameras underground, and I would have very many different types of particles and compounds, and I would just make kind of a model of the whole network and what's going on. Whereas currently I'm looking at two plants in a tiny little box, and one type of nutrient, and one type of particle, and so on. So I would scale it up for sure. And if I could fantasize for things that
Please
don't even
do.
Exist,
yeah.
Then I would love to have like some kind of a nano scale, tiny GPS that I could connect to all of the things that are moving in this network. And then some kind of very powerful analysis software so that I could make like a 3D model of the whole network and of all the things that are moving in there, and make like some kind of a time-lapse system of this. And then I could see exactly like what is going where and when and what route are they taking? And this would be amazing.
You know, there is this very popular thing in Estonia right now, the cameras in the nature, so that people can take a look at what's going on in the nature when just sitting at home. So you can do a camera just observing what goes on beneath the ground.
Yes, that would be super interesting. And not just for the fungi, also for the other creatures that are there. And I mean fungi as well. Many people don't know, but they're actually quite interesting. Like some of them are predatory, for example. They have like tiny rings. And when a tiny nematode, which is a type of small insect, crawls into this loop, it kind of strangles it, and then it sucks out the nutrients from this. So it's actually predating. And people don't know this
murderous
kind of stuff.
Mushrooms.
Indeed, some of them do this for real.
You mentioned expertise as well as one thing that you could benefit from if you...
Sure.
So could you elaborate a bit on the expertise?
Well, although we have like very knowledgeable people already on the project, still what I would want is to have people who actually did ecological experiments with these nanoparticles. That's what I'm lacking right now, because we have people who know about nanoparticles, we have people who know about the ecosystems, about the fungi, but to have someone who actually has some experience connecting these two, that would be so helpful, because the problem that we keep facing is that the people that know about their fields, they don't understand the other side. And then it's kind of my job to try to gather some kind of information from both parties and kind of make sense about, okay, what is relevant for us? And okay, what does this person need to know from this side to like make their work possible?
So basically, as I said, you are kind of the person who connects the dots.
Well,
and makes sense of the dots.
I'm trying to, yes.
What if you could start all over again? What would you do the same? What would you do differently?
Well, I would not change the topic, that's for sure. It's not an easy thing to do. And sometimes in a moment of despair, I do think like, why did I get onto this? Why can't I just do something that's like something that has a ready-made protocol and I can just like follow this and do it and that's done. But the fact about this is that it's really like you need to be incredibly passionate to do this. Like if I wasn't borderline obsessed about this topic, I don't know, I might have given up already, because there's going to be setbacks, there's a lot of unknowns, and well, work-life balance is non-existent and so on. So it's not something that you just think like, oh, okay, I'm just gonna breeze through some mildly interesting topic and then get a fancy degree. Just don't. That's not how it works.
How is it? What makes it difficult to balance between work and life as a PhD student, especially when you are doing something that is completely new in the field?
Well, I guess in the start, it's mostly because you just don't want to stop. You just want to keep going and you get really immersed into like the literature, for example. And then at some point, you're just like reading and reading and you're uploading like hundreds of papers into your Mendeley or whatever. And you just then realize that, okay, it's like 10 in the evening and I didn't eat since morning. And it's like completely ruins any kind of balance and routine. And also because the work is like quite independent, you have to have like a really strict control of your time yourself. It's not like many jobs where you just, okay, your work starts at 8 and then you're there and then you leave at 4 and then you forget about it. You have to yourself kind of make the limits. And when there's pressure coming from peers, from supervisors, from the general idea that you need to publish and you have a limited amount of time and so on, it can be really hard to justify taking the time for yourself.
But you need to take time for yourself.
Sure.
But how do you take time for yourself? Have you thought about it?
Well, at first, when I started, I said to myself that, okay, I will keep at least one day, either Saturday or Sunday, when I don't do my PhD. But this has already gone out the window. It's not happening at the moment. But it, you really have to like observe yourself, and when you feel that you're like losing focus and you cannot like move forward, then it's better to stop for a while. That's my idea anyway, because you can't just like use all of your energy and try to push when you don't have any energy. So you have to be reasonable with yourself and kind of merciful and say, okay, well, right now I'm too tired. I cannot do this. So I need to take a break.
And it's said that the greatest ideas come from people who just let go for a bit. You know, you come back and see it and something like some object or a question you've been tackling with. You see it from another light. You see it from
Definitely.
Another angle. And you know, taking time off helps. But do you think, or what do you think about the fact that taking time off is one of the problems that PhD students face?
Mm-hmm. You know,
the problem of how to take off, take time off, when to take time off. What do you think about it? Is it something that's widespread among?
I think so, certainly. I mean, at least.
But why is it?
Well, I think part of it is because of the position of a PhD student, because in a way you're a student still, but in a way you're also kind of a worker. And sometimes it feels like you kind of have the responsibilities of a worker, but the rights of, I don't know, not even a student.
That there are these different roles that you are in at the same time. And,
yes.
And you might have difficulties jumping between the roles.
Yes, that's certainly part of it, I would say. But also, it's just the immense pressure, because everybody knows that PhD is hard, and everybody knows that it's hard to get it done in time and so on. So people kind of take a lot of things. They're willing to like stand a lot of things just because they know that, okay, yes, PhD is hard, and they think that this is how it's supposed to be. But that's part of the issue then, and we should really address it and not just keep up this kind of assumption that, okay, it's normal for a PhD student that you work every day for 14 hours in the lab. That's just how it is to do a PhD, because that's not healthy and it's not sustainable.
And it, I would say that it doesn't encourage the philosophical thinking or whatever you put it as, you know.
No, not at all.
Because you need time to think things through.
Yes,
even
yes,
if you
indeed.
Find something in the lab, I would say you need time to see it from different angles.
For sure, for sure.
Otherwise, you just see the one thing and it might not, you know, reach the full potential.
Yes, and the more you just keep muddling about with some kind of a problem, quite often you think that you're getting clarity, but actually you're just like, it's like putting your hand in the bottom of a lake. You're just making the water more muddy the more you touch it. So it just creates more confusion, and it takes a whole lot of energy also, this kind of thought processing. So you should do something to get you out of your head, for sure. I am physically maybe a bit drained, but mentally I still am so passionate about my topic that it kind of overrides this. And I haven't had a summer holiday yet. Hopefully I will have time to keep like a week or something in the summer when I don't do this. And that will already help, because yes, it's been a year and I haven't rested. So I would say that my situation is quite good still at the moment, but it's a fine line still. So you are the one who has to like keep observing the situation, and you have to know your limits and be like, okay, this is too much. Because no one else is going to do it. That's the fact.
That's true. That's true. Thank you, Sunny, for being the guest on our podcast. Thank you for sharing your ideas and thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
And I wish you the best of luck with your research, because your energy and the way you talk about the topic itself shows that you are very enthusiastic about it, what you are doing. And I think it's so important for a young scientist to be that way. Otherwise, you'll be off the rails altogether right away.
Indeed, indeed. As I said, passion is essential, I feel.